Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in once again. It's David Summers hosting another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America, as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So let's step back into the ring and back into time. Let's get wall to wall and treetop tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Okay, Ron, so I gotta say, at the end of the last Studcast, you said plans were for this Studcast, as far as the hidden history lesson, would be talking about beginning negotiations with Nick Gullis in Nashville to see if Southeastern could buy the northern part of Alabama from him back in 1980. Then, a couple of days after the last Studcast was released, I saw those social media posts about a big card in Lexington, Kentucky that involved both Southeastern and the Memphis territory, and that you were going to now change your hidden history subject. All right, so is any of that true?
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of sorry to say, maybe, Dave, yeah, I believe it is, man. You know, I saw this post, man, of a card for Lexington, Kentucky, on May the 3rd, 1979, in the world-famous Rupp Arena, which is almost exactly 45 years ago, just this past week, I would say. So it was the perfect subject matter, you know, for my hidden history lessons, because, you know, we've been doing these every week for a while now, and this card had several significant stories behind it, man, all great hidden history stories. Fans never get to see this type of thing or hear about it. What really went on behind the scenes of professional wrestling, obviously, because back in those days, it was pretty much a kayfabe world. So I couldn't resist, man, this historic opportunity, basically, to pull back the kayfabe curtain and tell the entire compelling story, not only behind this event, but the territory itself, especially since we spent a lot of time last week discussing bookers.
Yeah.
So this card was not only a great booker story, but even more a lesson about greed. It was the perfect hidden history lesson for wrestling fans, with all the intrigue that the past fans from way back never were privy to, man.
Okay. So I love the Studcast title on this one. Greedy Territory in Trouble and Bob Returns. One part about wrestling history and the other part about a historic wrestler. I can't wait to hear this one, Stud.
Well, this card, man, was pure wrestling history, man. And not simply for the fact that it was one of the first ever wrestling events of any kind allowed in the beautiful University of Kentucky 20,000-seat Adolph Rupp basketball arena, but also for what was happening behind the scenes in a territory that had been really failing in the 1979. So for those that may not know, Adolph Rupp was one of the most famous, successful basketball coaches of all time, mm-hmm. in a state that's known for that sport. And if there is one, they are definitely known for basketball. So for wrestling to even be held in that venue, it was in itself a real honor.
Wow. So what was on this intriguing card in Rupp Arena, May 3rd, 1979? Take us there, Stud.
Okay, so the opening match was Buzz Sawyer, and Buzz was coming from the southeastern Gulf Coast territory. He was against the Alaskan, Hans Schmoder, who actually is the guy I wrestled in Australia in 1973. He at this point had made it into America. He was wrestling against Tony Charles, who was also from a southeastern territory, southeastern Gulf Coast. Then they had a woman's match, Winona Littlehart against Suzette Ferrara. Jimmy Golden from southeastern Gulf Coast was facing Tommy Gilbert. In a southeastern championship match, Ronnie Garvin, who was the champion for southeastern Knoxville, was defending against Ron Slinker, who happened to be also in southeastern Knoxville. And in a southern heavyweight championship match, Tori Tanaka was defending against the Mongolian Stomper, managed by Gorgeous George Jr. And all three of these guys came out of southeastern Gulf Coast. Then in the Southern Tag Championship match, Robert was partners with Bill Dundee. They were wrestling against the Assassins, managed by Gorgeous George Jr. So three of the contestants in this match were from southeastern Gulf Coast. And then the last match was a cage match with the loser leave, Jerry Lawler versus Austin Idol. So 10 of the 17 men on this card were from the two southeastern territories and representing the Memphis territory in one of their cities. So it's kind of a tale of three territories at this point. So let's go back, Dave, 5 months before this Kentucky card to the beginning of 1979. And let's start kind of naming the players in this remarkable story. And this is a remarkable story. The Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory had only been in business for 10 months, and it held its first event on March the 3rd, 1978, at Andre the Giant in Dothan, Alabama. The territory was owned by my brother Robert, Jimmy Golan, Roy Lee Welch, Bob Armstrong, and myself. Bob and I had been booking it in 1978 from the time it started, until both of us returned to wrestle in the southeastern Knoxville territory in September of 1978. The southeastern territory Knoxville had been in operation for 5 years, since late 1974. I was the sole owner there, and it was being booked by Robert until September of 1978, when I made Bob Roop the booker, and I sent my brother south to the Gulf Coast territory, because he had not at that point ever been down there. So to assure Robert's success as a booker, I immediately started to send him some of the Tennessee talent that had made a huge winner out of Knoxville. I sent him wrestlers like the Mongolian Stomper, Gorgeous George Jr., Tora Tanaka, the Assassin was sent down there, Jimmy Golan, Tony Charles, Buzz Sawyer, Ron Slinker was sent down there, and he had to come back at this point into the southeastern Knoxville territory. So by the end of 1978, with all these new wrestlers, the southeastern Gulf Coast territory basically caught on fire. And I mean, you know, so much great talent went in there over a 2 or 3 month period of time. So this list contained 9 of the 10, the guys I just mentioned. That's 9 of the 10 guys out of the southeastern Gulf Coast alone. It was on this Lexington card of May the 3rd, 1979. And it was by far the largest part of this card, obviously, and a great deal of the reason that it is, you know, the focus of this hidden history lesson. So I'm going to explain that all as this story progresses, and fans are going to see exactly what was going on behind the scenes in 1979. So we start out with the Memphis territory. It was basically a new territory that had been created in the latter 1970s. And it was created because my father and Jerry Jarrett were partners in the Memphis territory, and they had a disagreement with Nick Gulas after the death of my grandfather, Roy, in 1977. So, you know, there was a problem there between Nick, my dad, and Jerry Jarrett. So Nick even attempted to take Memphis away from him. Ran a couple of cards in Memphis that didn't do very well, you know, and they finally decided that they were going to split up the original Tennessee territory that Roy had developed. many, many years earlier. So Nick was going to own Nashville, Chattanooga, Birmingham, Alabama, and the smaller cities in those areas. And my father and Jerry Jarrett were going to get Memphis, Louisville, and Lexington, Kentucky, Evansville, Indiana, and the smaller cities along the Mississippi River in their part of the country.
Wow.
So during 1978, the Memphis territory was in bad trouble. Jerry Jarrett was doing their booking. Their crew wasn't the best, and they were having trouble at the box office throughout that year. Horrible trouble. Most of their problem was one word, greed. As a result of the May 3rd, 1979 Lexington card, they had 10 wrestlers out of the 17 men wrestling on that card. They were all Southeastern stars. And only three of the Memphis wrestlers that was on this card, being what I would consider were quality wrestlers. So their payoff percentage was the reason they were having trouble for so long. They had not paid anywhere near what I was paying and what most guys were paying in order to be successful and keep yourself a great crew. So toward the end of 1978, when Southeastern Gulf Coast was on fire, without asking for my permission, since I owned the Knoxville territory and more than 50% of the Gulf Coast territory, they saw fit, my father and Jerry Jarrett, to offer my brother a job as booker for them, okay? And that was a real no-no in the wrestling business. By doing that, they had overstepped their bounds, and that was not the way to handle getting another territory's booker, especially without asking the owner's permission. So, but since my father and my brother were members of my family and involved in this, and the Memphis territory was in such bad shape at the box office, I agreed for them to go ahead and take my Southeastern Gulf Coast booker, my brother, but there was never a mention of them taking any of our wrestlers. So Robert was, to leave for Memphis in January 1979, about 5 months before this card that we're talking about here, and that's the focus of this hidden history lesson. And I was suddenly without a booker in the Gulf Coast. So I got in touch with Louis Tillette and had him come in and take over the book in 1979 Southeastern Gulf Coast. So before Robert left to go to Memphis, he and I, we knew the history of their payoffs there in Memphis, and that they weren't good. And, and they were much less than what I had been traditionally paying. And so I put together a contract for Rob that I said, take this down there and get it signed or you're not going to go. And I required them to allow Rob to figure the payoffs for their wrestlers, which, it was much more money on each show than they had ever paid before. Their small payoffs were the main reason they didn't have quality wrestlers. So my payoff percentage of the gross house was always 28%. Of the big, whatever the house was, you just multiplied that by 28%, and that's what you paid out. And it was the same amount I'd always paid my wrestlers. And Rob was aware of it because when he booked for me, I always allowed him to make the payoff. So, now he's in a position where they've got to allow him to make the payoffs, and they've got to pay 28%. So their payoff percentage of gross, what they were used to and accustomed to paying was 20% as compared to 28. So that 8% more to the wrestlers from each gross house made a huge difference, man, to each wrestler. Big difference. But if you wanted to attract some of the best wrestlers in the world, it was a necessity. I mean, you could not pay that small of a number and keep great wrestlers. So they signed an actual contract starting stating that 28% of each house would be calculated by Robert and paid by them before I allowed Rob to go. So then shortly after Rob arrived in Memphis, all of a sudden, Louis Tillette gets in touch with me. Me and Bob are back at this point in Knoxville. And he says, Ron, I'm getting out a lot of notices from a lot of these wrestlers, particularly the guys that's worked under Robert when he was up there in Tennessee. And and he said, what's going on here, basically? What's happening here? So within weeks, many of those guys that had lit up the crowd since coming down there to the Gulf Coast 3 months earlier were now leaving to go to Memphis.
Wow. Okay. So I think we've touched on some of this in past studcasts, because I remember when this happened in early 1979 in the Gulf Coast territory, Louis really had to scramble to find new wrestlers, and your territory actually dropped off in attendance, if I recall. So how about things, how did things go, say, in the Memphis territory while this was all happening?
Well, very well, you know, like it had, you know, in late 1978, when I was sending that group of stars from Knoxville down there to the southeastern Gulf Coast. They lit that territory up down there in Pensacola, and the same thing started to happen in Memphis. They started selling out in the Memphis territory. Everywhere they'd been drawing half a house months earlier was now a sellout. So about the time on May the 3rd, 1979, when this big card we've been talking about for Lexington, Kentucky was running, my father and Jarrett, due to their greed, brought my brother into their office, and they told him, because business now was so good, they said, we no longer need to pay 28% to the wrestlers. but we had a contract. Rob had a contract. Hey, look, this was the deal. Mm-hmm. And they says, because the town is doing so good, all these cities are selling out, we can drop back and pay in that 20% and still make pay the wrestlers really good. Mm-hmm. Well, that wasn't the deal. Mm. So, Rob kind of warned them that, doing that was going to cost them a big time, that they would lose the southeastern wrestlers who were already down up in Memphis and accustomed to making more money per week. As soon as that pay suddenly dropped dramatically, with the crowds remaining at the record levels, they're going to look at the house and go, wait a minute, what happened to the money? So that the better southeastern talent would leave them, that they would be back where they were 5 months earlier. So they told him that they wanted to keep that extra money for themselves, that it wasn't necessary to pay that much. We had a real thing going here, man.
All right. So this is definitely something fans would never know about if you were not doing these hidden history of the sport lessons. You were really a great guy to let Memphis take a big number of your wrestlers and then decide, when business got good, to change the deal they made on how to pay them. So can you give us an example of how much difference maybe a 28% payoff would be compared to a 20% payoff?
Yeah, it's fairly simple, And let's just do it on this Lexington card that we're talking about. So we've been talking about, in fact, this Lexington card was the first one to get this 8% drop in pay, So the card, the card drew 12,000 fans with an average ticket price of $5, a little under $5 a ticket. That was a $60,000 gross gain. So the 28% of the pay of the gross gate would have amounted to almost $17,000, but 20% amounted to only $13,000, which was about $3,500 less money to the wrestlers than they should have been getting. So that amounted to a difference of $350 for each of those 10 guys that were on that card. They all got $350 less than they should have for this house. And so Southeastern men on the card, they were upset, So if the next five nights, let's say, in that territory produced 100,000 gross in the next five shows at that 20% off figure, that would be $8,000 less payoff in those five nights, equaling $800 less per man for those five nights. Then you add the $350 they got cheated out of in the show in Lexington, that would amount to $1,150 less per man per week for that week. So wow. That $1,150 total loss per wrestlers for just 1 week, in today's money, Dave, that would have equaled more than $5,000 less per man.
Wow, that really makes a difference. So let me see if I get this straight. That 8% deduction in total payoff equaled $1,150 less per man in 1979, which was a huge amount of money back in that day, and equal to $5,000 less each man in today's money. So what happened with Robert and the Memphis territory?
Well, as you said earlier, man, I'd been over backwards, man, to help them there, you know, and I let them take Rob, and then I let them take a lot of the wrestlers that I had there. And so when Rob told me about this, that they didn't want to continue to do the deal, and he said, they told me that if I didn't want to do it, they were going to fire me. So I told him, I said, give them a 2-week notice and come home to Knoxville. Me and Bob are here. Come on down to Knoxville, man. So that was in early May, 1979. And there were no signs of any problems with southeastern Knoxville until, obviously, about a month later, we got the five guys, the Knoxville Five, I call them, that left the crew and decided they were going to steal the territory. So about the time that all these wrestlers figured out they're not going to get paid like they were before, and I had suddenly a great need for talent myself, then I started to get these calls from the guys out of Memphis, you know, and they started leaving. They started coming, some went to Knoxville. I sent some to Knoxville. I sent others down to the Gulf Coast. I'd already found that we're new stars, down there in the southeastern Gulf Coast. Besides what Louis had, he had already at that point found Hulk Hogan. He was about to bring in Austin Idol.
Yeah.
So, you know, that territory down there was going to be in good shape.
Wow. This really has been a remarkable story, Stud. It seemed like when something went wrong, then somehow something went right. It's funny how that happens from time to time. So what happened in the Memphis territory after Robert finally got out of there?
Well, they quickly went right back to hard times. I mean, you know, their houses dropped dramatically because the talent had all gone back to the original southeastern territories. And they eventually recovered, but it took them probably more than a year. And then I often wondered if they changed their percentage of payoff to even make that happen. Because, you know, if they continued to pay like they weren't ever going to recover. But they managed to recover finally probably in late 1980.
I wonder that, too. Okay, I tell you what, this has been a tremendous way to open this studcast. I can see why you decided to switch to this subject for the hidden history lesson. We're going to take our break. Let's do that now and come back after the break with the second 7-match card in a row in all 3 major southeastern cities. That is going to happen when we come back as this studcast continues. All right, studcast fans, if you've never heard of a super studcast, you have no idea what or who you are missing. There are 43 of them. On the website at tnstud.com, most all of them 3 hours long and only $2.99 each. The Stud dives into conversations with some of the biggest stars in the history of the sport, like Bob Armstrong, Mick Foley, Austin Idol, and Kevin Sullivan, to name a few. In others, he tells his personal recollections of wrestlers such as Andre the Giant, Ron Wright, and more, or his own fantastic stories of places like wrestling in the Caribbean. It's the best deal in wrestling. TNstud.com. Click Super Studcast and take the ride of your life for only $2.99. Saddle up. Hey, welcome back. Another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. I'm David Summers. This is episode number 348. It's called Greedy Territory in Trouble and Bob Returns. That's the title of this one. So we'll focus on Mobile, Alabama on Tuesday, April 29th, 1980. So set up that southeastern card for this studcast, Stud.
Okay, so it was another 7-match card. We'd had the first time last studcast ever to have a 7-match card down there in southeastern Gulf Coast. And this was a second time to have a seven-match card. This one had three championship matches on it. The opening match was the popular Ricky Fields out of Mobile, Alabama. This was his home. And he was wrestling against, of all people, the Big C. The next match was Norvell Austin returning against Charlie Cook in a first ever headbutt match, which could only be won with a headbutt following a pin.
Wow.
And we'll talk a little bit about how that all came about. Then there was a special event. The winner was going to get a shot at the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion Tony Charles the following week. And it was going to be Fabulous Don Fargo against Dick Steinborn. Two heels. Fourth match on the card was the Texas Death Match. Randy Rose taking on Eddie Boulder. Then there was the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match with the belt on the line. Champion Tony Charles wrestling against an old-time fan favorite in that area, Greg Peterson. Then Robert and I were getting a return championship match against the team that had beaten us the week before with the help of Big C. And we were going to be wrestling against the new Southeastern Tag Champions, Ron Bass and Dr. Bill Irwin. They were going to be managed again by the Big C. Then the seventh and the last match on that that card was the new champion, Bob Armstrong, Southeastern champion, returning to Southeastern, basically riding on the win of the Georgia Jawjacker from the week before over the Mongolian Stomper, who was managed by the Big C. Armstrong was going to be defending against the former champion, Mongolian Stomper, who until last week had been undefeated for three straight months.
Okay, so that was another huge card, obviously, with all kinds of important matches on it. I mean, filled with rivalries from first match to the last match. This should be another great TV with a card like this, Dud.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was absolutely loaded, Dave, the TV. It had five videos alone in it from three different cities, and it had two new champions crowned the week before. It opened with a video, which was already in progress from Mobile, Alabama, with a fight going on between two wrestlers that weren't even booked to wrestle against each other. And the champion who was scheduled to be wrestling in the match, Tony Charles, who was watching the fight that was going on, sitting on the top rope of the ring and enjoying it just as much as the Mobile crowd was. I mean, so it had a great opening. And, you know, like I said, it opened in progress. So, you know, first thing they see is this fight going on, and you hear the commentary. Charlie thanked Tony for joining him. Tony's then at the set with him, and they quickly explained how Dick Steinborn had interrupted the match right after the bell rang for this United States Junior Heavyweight title match, supposed to have been between Tony Charles and Don Fargo. But here comes Steinborn after the bell rings, and after that interruption, you know, Fargo didn't like it, and he just tore into, instead of going after Charles, he went after Steinborn. So Tony, you know, you could see in the video, he's sitting on the top rope, and he's laughing at what's going on. You know, a video was shot 4 days earlier, and he told Charlie in his 15-year career, he said, "I've never seen anything like this," you know. And he goes, "Two of my opponents, you know, are fighting to see which one's going to get a shot at my belt." So it turned out to be funny for Tony Charles. So Charlie told fans, "Pay attention," he said, "because the best part is yet to come here." So it was about that time in the video, Steinborn and Fargo, they were fighting each other, and they shot. I think Fargo shot Steinborn into the ropes, and then they collided, and Steinborn went flying out of the ring backwards, and Fargo went down in the ring. And then Tony Charles just very slowly and calmly climbed down from the top rope. He walked over and covered Fargo. And then Fargo was counted out, you know. So, and then Charlie noted in the deal, he says, "I'll be darned," he goes, "you won your match, Tony, without even breaking a sweat." So the studio crowd got a big pop out of that one right off the bat. So Charlie thanked Tony for being there, you know, and he announced that Tony was going to be defending his belt again the coming week against neither one of these two guys, because they're going to be wrestling against each other to see if they can wrestle him the following week, and that he's going to be wrestling against longtime favorite down there, Greg Peterson, who lived just down the road, I guess, Bonifay, just outside Dothan. So yep. The news, you know, then the news got around, and it got another pop from the crowd. They had not seen Greg Peterson in a long, long time. So Tony had barely left the set before Don Fargo. He came running out to the set, you know, and wanted to give his opinion of what they'd just shown, you know, and how he lost the championship match because the guy decided he wanted to get in the ring and run his mouth. And he goes, you know, he said, this is a horrible way for me to lose. Because I never got to lay my hands on the champion. I never got to even touch the champion. He pinned me, and I didn't even get a chance. So so he was about to ramble on, and then Charlie told him, he said, you know, he says, we're about to get a look at that intruder you just talked about. He said, he's in the first match of the day. So the ring announcer, he introduced Dick Steinborn. He was talking about Dick Steinborn. Steinborn wasn't in the ring yet, but his opponent was. Then the announcer, TV announcer, announced Steinborn's opponent. And then as Steinborn was entering the ring, the announcer never got a chance to finish introducing Steinborn. Fargo just left the set, went flying into the ring. He grabbed Steinborn's opponent, threw him over the top rope. And then here they go again. He tore into Steinborn.
Wow.
And the studio audience, they went crazy, man. They were like, wow, look at what we're getting to see here. Then, you know, two heels fighting. Who wouldn't like that, right?
So wow.
This show was barely 5 minutes in, man. We had pandemonium going on.
Wow, these two guys really had been doing nothing but fighting each other since Steinborn had arrived, just the week before.
Yeah, it wasn't just a brief encounter either, Dave. They were scheduled to meet each other in the coming week with the winner going to get Tony Charles and the shot at the belt. But this match, it turned into a brawl. I mean, wow, both men got bloody. I mean, and it took two referees and three wrestlers to separate them. To get the bell was ringing continuously because they wasn't a scheduled match, so they just started ringing the bell as soon as they went into each other. That bell rang for 4 or 5 minutes, and, you know, it was kind of an unusual deal, man.
Okay, so what a way to start a TV show, no doubt. I'm almost afraid to ask, who was next on the TV show?
Yeah, no kidding. So it was a patched-up Eddie Boulder in the next match, and he was attacked by Randy Rose on the TV from the week before, and Rose busted him open, so he was at the set with Eddie Boulder. Was at the set with Charlie, and they watched the video. This video came from Montgomery, Alabama, 2 days earlier. After the TV match, Boulder got even in this one, and this time Rose was bleeding in this one. So there's another video, one from Montgomery this time. So they were scheduled to be coming back the next week against each other in a Texas death match. So Charlie invited Boulder to stay at the set with him and watch Randy Rose, who was going to be the next TV match. So Eddie declined the invitation, you know, and he said, you know, something like, you know, after what just happened in that first match, he goes, he said, I don't know if I'm going to be able to sit here and this close to Rose and not do the same thing we you just saw up there, end up in the ring too. So to me, that showed a lot of maturity for him, you know, to not take a chance of doing something stupid like Rose had done to him the week before. So besides that, the upcoming Texas death match, he was going to have plenty of time and have his chance, man, every opportunity to get even during that Texas death match. So Rose, naturally, he didn't waste his opportunity to show his nastiness. He busted eye and all because he hadn't been busted up in that video they had just watched. He took no pity on his opponent, man, and he finished him off with another one of those devastating clotheslines. You know, his arm stretched across the guy's throat, and mm-hmm. the opponent, looked like a man about took the guy's head off.
Wow.
So he seemed ready for one of the first ever Texas death matches that I think either one of those two guys had.
Well, this TV was turning into a great one. So who and what was on the personality profile? Set that up for us, Dud.
Well, this was a very rare three-part personality profile. It opened with Charlie Platt on the profile set by himself. And he explained he was going to talk to three people during this profile, but he wanted to first show the ending of a match from the week before that might have been, and I think he put it something like one of the most important matches in Southeastern history. He said, we're going to see the match and where so much had been riding on all these special stipulations for the Southeastern Championship belt between the Mongolian Stomper and the Georgia Jawjacker. So the video opened up with the Jawjacker in trouble in the corner. Referee was pushing Stomper away from the Jawjacker, who was just basically hanging over the second rope in the corner of the ring. And standing there is the Big C, who had already beat my brother with using his loaded glove. And he was ready to end the Jawjacker and Bob Armstrong's Southeastern career. All they had to do was get a pin on the Jawjacker. So if the Jawjacker lost, the deal was he had to remove his mask. And if he was Bob Armstrong, Armstrong was going to be banned from Southeastern wrestling forever. And if the Jawjacker won, he could continue to wear his mask if he wanted to, or he could choose to remove it. And if he was Bob Armstrong, he'd be able to return to Southeastern wrestling. So either way, he would be the new champion, no matter, what his decision was. So for those diehard fans that filled the Southeastern buildings the week before to witness this match, they knew who won. They already knew who won. They had seen it, but for the thousands and thousands of fans that stayed home and didn't see it, this was kind of the moment that they had been nervously waiting on. They wanted to know what happened in this match. So the video showed me, coming down with a steel chair. Big C's about to load the glove and hit Jawjacker with it. And it shows me come down with a steel chair and I'm behind Big C. He never sees me coming, man. And he's loading that black glove and he was ready to change Southeastern wrestling history forever. And I turned his lights out, man. I knocked him unconscious with that chair and even left the chair hanging around his neck on the floor. And so the building exploded. The Mongolian Stomper, he saw it. He'd been trying to keep the referee's attention in the far corner so that Big C could get what he needed done, and it didn't work for him. So he saw what happened. He ran across the ring and he reached through the ropes trying to get a hold of me, and the Jawjacker just kind of slid in behind him, pulled him over backwards, and came up on top and with a little schoolboy move and got the three count. The building exploded again, man. So that's where, Charlie had the show's director then at this point stop the video. And he said, and he invited out Don Carson and the Mongolian Stomper from their dressing room to come and join him at the set. So Don Carson arrived there, Don was madder than I'd ever seen him. I mean, he was just uncontrollable. Charlie invited him to sit down, but he was too angry to accept the invitation. And, he said, Don Curtis and the Southeastern Division officials, they knew when they banned me from the building that my champion, the Mongolian Stomper, had no chance to win this match that you just showed. And he said, this whole thing was a setup basically to get me out of Southeastern. But, but they're going to be sorry about this because the Big C is still here and he don't have to leave. And he's going to be creating pandemonium here every night. So Charlie didn't make it easy on him. He told everyone because he was there that night that he had witnessed what the Big C had done earlier in the night in the match for the Southeastern Tag Championship, where he loaded the glove, he hit Rob with it, and basically there's new tag team champions because of the Big C's interference. And and he said, we're going to show that a little bit later in the show. So then Charlie said to Carson, though, he finally got Carson quieted down, and he said, you know, Don, he said, I only invited you out here today to say goodbye.
Wow.
Well, the studio audience exploded. And the celebration began, man. So Carson and the Stomper, they were nuts. And, you know, Stomper had kind of been standing back, but now they crawled out on top of him, practically. Just perched over Charlie, screaming at him, you know, and in a really threatening manner, man. And then the third guy that was scheduled to be on the profile, he saw this, I'm sure, sitting back on the monitor in the dressing room, what was happening to Charlie. And all of a sudden, Bob Armstrong exploded from that dressing room. He ran to the set to protect Charlie. And everybody in the studio was instantly on their feet, man. As the Stomper and Don Carson, they took off running for the dressing room. And it was the first time these fans had seen Bob's face in months. So it was like goosebump time for me, man. I mean, that place went crazy. I never heard a studio so loud. So Bob seeing Stomper and Carson flee, he just went straight past Charlie, and he just went running right up into the bleachers with the fans. They covered him up. He disappeared, and they were just all over him and patting him on the back. And it was a homecoming, man, like no other I'd ever seen before in the wrestling bit. So when he was finally able to get away from the studio crowd, he went back to the set with Charlie. And when that happened, Rob and I, you know, grabbed his belt. He had the Southeastern belt, or it was the Jawjacker's belt. The Jawjacker won the match. But, so we grabbed the belt and we took the belt out there to Bob. And we congratulated him and gave him the belt. We welcomed him home and we went back to the dressing room. But the studio was literally on fire. I mean, they never calmed down for the last part of this profile. So when things got a little bit quieter where they could talk, Charlie asked the director to show the last part of the video, of this video for Mobile. And this was where Charlie had entered the ring. He came from Dothan to see the match, and he entered the ring and he grabbed the microphone and he told fans, he said, ladies and gentlemen, Don Carson has now been banned from Southeastern for an entire year.
Wow.
Got a big pop in the building, obviously. And then he asked the Georgia Jawjacker, who was standing there. He said, you've just beaten the Stomper. And he goes, have you decided what you're going to do about wearing your mask?
Mm-hmm.
He said, are you going to keep it and remain the Jawjacker, or are you going to remove it and welcome home his good friend, Bob Armstrong?
Right.
So the Jawjacker took the microphone and said, I think, Charlie, that the Georgia Jawjacker has done his job here. And he said, it's now time for Bob Armstrong to come home.
How about that?
And boy, the people erupted, the building erupted again. And the people in the video in the buildings, he pulled his mask off and he threw that mask up the ceiling in the building. Wow, people went crazy in the building. It was a record crowd in Expo Hall, too. For the first time, we hit 6,000 people. I guess the fire marshal wasn't watching very good. Then the studio audience and the Dothan TV, it exploded. Everything was going nuts there. It'd been a tremendous, tremendous thing.
Well, I bet you would be hard pressed to find a market like the city of Dothan that were bigger fans of Bob Armstrong. He was huge everywhere he went, but it seemed like he embraced the Dothan market, and they certainly embraced him. All right, listen, we've been having some great personality profiles each week lately, but this one has to be one of the best ever. It had everything, all the ups and downs. So how do you follow that, Stud?
Well, to be honest with you, man, you really don't follow that, Dave. How do you follow that? But we had to finish out the TV. So, there were still two segments to go. So Charlie, Charlie Cook had joined Charlie Platt. They went back to the regular set, but the studio audience was still buzzing. You know, they had a two-minute commercial there, and when they came out of the commercial, you could still hear the fans over there on the bleachers going crazy. So Charlie Cook began in a really good way. Right off, he welcomed back Bob Armstrong, you know, and told him that he had watched this match from the week before. And from Montgomery, he watched the match with him and Norvell Austin. They were going to be meeting for the first time ever in their careers, which is really amazing. They had been in the same territory off and on a long time, but had never wrestled before. So this match ends up in a headbutt contest. You know, neither of them won, basically. Norvell did his diving headbutt toward the end of it, and Charlie had headbutted Norvell several times. Both of them ended up basically knocking themselves out. They laid there on the mat. Nobody won. Ref counted them both out to 10, rang the bell, and there was no winner. I decided, you know, let's give them a headbutt match. Let's create some kind of match for it that had never been done. So they were going to be coming back against each other the next week, and it was going to be the first ever headbutt match. And the only way you could win it was with a headbutt and a pin.
Yeah, I got a headache just thinking about all that. All right, so who was in the next TV match?
Well, Norvell Austin. And it didn't take long for him to show he had a winning move that was the use of a headbutt. That's how he won his match. The guy in there, and he hit him one of those diving headbutts, and you could tell he was ready to use it on. He was going to use it on his opponent in the very next headbutt match.
All right, Stud, and I always remember Norvell Austin as a kid. I remember he had the most notorious headbutt. I don't know if anybody else used a headbutt like that way back then, but that, to me, we always remembered Norvell Austin for that. Okay, so who was in the last TV match, Stud?
Man, it was the new Southeastern Tag Champions, Ron Bass and Dr. Bill Irwin. But Rob and I had started the segment at the desk with Charlie, and we were watching the results of the match where we lost the belts from Mobile. And it was the match Charlie had mentioned in the profile that we're going to be able to show later. And it showed Rob getting blasted by Big C's Black Glove and getting pinned by Ron Bass as the way we lost the belts. And so we declined to watch the upcoming tag match, which Charlie invited us. You know, these guys are going to be wrestling, and we said, you know, no, we're not interested because, you know, we made a point. We said, you know, Don Carson's banned from Southeastern. But, you know, his alter ego, the Big C, still here, you know. And we would probably be champions still if it wasn't for the Big C. So, you know, we don't have any interest in seeing that. So the Big C was not in their corner for this TV match. He wasn't there. But Bass and Irwin, man, they didn't need him. They certainly didn't need him, that's for sure. Those boys were two big old boys and two bad, bad son of a guns, man, at the top of their game, man, and they demolished their two opponents. There was nothing to that match.
I'll tell you, that was an extremely interesting TV show.
Well, it wasn't over, Dave. You know, it ended kind of similar to the last TV show, which was the Big C on the last TV show, with his Black Glove coming to the set with Charlie. And so he's back at the set again on the end of this one. And he reminded everyone that he was still in Southeastern and he wasn't going anywhere. And because of what had happened to his good friend Don Carson, he said, I'm more committed than ever to make life miserable for the commissioner Don Curtis, for all the Southeastern officials, and for all these sweet young baby faces here.
Wow. All right. So what happened in the arenas the following week, the last week in April of 1980?
Well, the Ricky Fields opening match against the Big C was a big surprise for everybody, man. I mean, the last thing you would have expected to happen, it was a 20-minute time limit match, and the Big C couldn't beat Ricky Fields. before the 20-minute time limit ran out. He had him down and out toward the end of the match four or five times and couldn't get the three count. So, you know, they were going to be coming back again against each other. Norvell Austin won the first ever headbutt match against Charlie Cook. And I think he did it with the diving headbutt. In the Texas Death Match, Eddie Boulder was in control. He had Randy Rose reeling. He'd taken fall after fall, man. I watched this match, and Norvell Austin goes down to ringside out of nowhere. And he's going to, and he starts banging on the apron and cheering on Randy Rose. And it wasn't but about a minute or two later that Charlie Cook came down to ringside, and he started cheering Boulder on. So before there was a winner to the match, both Austin and Cook, they ended up in the ring, and the match was stopped. It was declared a no contest, and four of these guys were going to be coming back the next week in a tag match. So these guys are going to be probably against each other for a little while. The next match had two heels in it, obviously Fabulous Don Fargo and Dick Steinborn. They were competing to get the winner's going to get the shot, the next shot at Tony Charles in his United States Junior Heavyweight Championship. And Dick Steinborn won that match. In the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match, Tony Charles beat Greg Peterson. In the return match for the Southeastern belts, it was a wild one. The Big C showed up at ringside with his champions, Ron Bass and Dr. Bill Irwin. So it appeared that Big C is going to become a manager for that team. And he ended up having to save him from a loss. Rob had Dr. Irwin pinned, and Big C jumped in the ring. He just came straight to the referee, who was down starting the three count, and stomped him in the back. And, you know, referee, what's he going to do? He had to, you know, disqualify the champions. And so he raised our hands, but obviously we didn't get the belts for it. So the last match of the night was the return match for the Southeastern title. Was the new champion at this point, Bob Armstrong, and the Mongolian Stomper, managed by the Big C. And they wrestled to a 45-minute time limit draw, which you didn't see that happen very often, man. So I think they're probably going to be coming back for an hour.
Wow. All right, so it sounds like a really great night. Here's the fun part for me. And so how about the attendances for this card from those three cities?
Well, Montgomery was down a little bit, but only 300 fans, from 45 down to 42. Dothan just dropped about 100 fans, basically, down to 4,400. And Mobile held up at above 5,000. So I was really happy, considering that that card before had been a monster card.
Wow, so you're looking at like 14,000 fans for three shows in those three markets. So this has been another really great studcast. I'm sorry we're not going to have enough time for the learning tree question this week. Hopefully we can get one in there next week. I thought the TV show for this studcast was one of the best ever. So where do we ride next week, Stud? How do you set it up?
Well, we're going to get to that expansion bid, basically, with Nick Gulas that I mentioned that I was going to do this on this show. We were going to try to add Birmingham and the northern part of Alabama to the southeastern Gulf Coast territory. This one's going to be a truly hidden history lesson, because you didn't talk about, nobody talked about how companies exchange hands and how these deals were done. To get controls of territories and to swap territories. This is really going to be a true hidden history lesson for this one. And all of this history we're going to be discussing next week. It basically began with my grandfather Roy's death in 1977.
Oh, wow.
So there's going to be not just a bunch of information about the sale, it'll be a lot of information about the Gulas family as well. So. Wow. This is going to be a real lesson in wrestling history. And we're also going to be moving into the month of May, 1980. Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory was setting records, while the former Southeastern Knoxville Territory was starting to fall apart up there in Knoxville. I mean, things were getting worse instead of better in that territory. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to be back to six matches, but all of them are going to be very interesting. And, you know, I've already kind of laid down what some of them are going to be about. And then hopefully you will have a learning tree question next podcast for sure.
All right, that's cool. All right, folks, you know how. If you want to contact the stud, he will contact you back on Facebook. Just find him at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, on Facebook. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a legend. If you make a comment, typically the stud will respond to that comment. Or if you send him a note, he's always real good about doing that, too. The same thing on Twitter, now known as X also. Ron Fuller Welch, you can follow him there, too. Check out the fantastic website at tnstudgod.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. Shop the stud store where you can get 43 super studcasts, four different 8x10 photos, the thrilling lion novel called Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts still on sale for only $15.99, all with free shipping. Subscribe to the YouTube channel Southeastern Rewind. It's so easy to find on YouTube. Just put in Southeastern Rewind in the search bar, and you can be there for hours and hours and find hundreds of hours of classic old school entertainment. You are going to love it. The last 123 studcast, 16 Ask the Stud shows, 115 short rides, and back 1 year or more. Discover fantastic stud stories about worldwide stars, 23 studcast archive stories, 23 Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and a whole lot more. That's YouTube Southeastern Rewind for the best deal in wrestling. All right, you get the last word, stud.
Well, thanks again, everybody, for joining us today, and we hope you've enjoyed it. Please tell your friends about us. Take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.